Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show where we talk about a subject that affects you every day, the United States Constitution. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia, and I'm speaking to you today from WETS-FM and HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Well, there are certain parts of the Constitution that they just seem to get all the attention, all the credit. You can think of the phrases yourself. Due process of law, equal protection of the law, the First Amendment, the Bill of Rights. Those are the parts that you always hear about. But there are lots of parts of the Constitution, parts that just seem a little bit odd, that seem a little bit strange. I mean, for example, do you know what a mark of reprisal is? Do you have any idea about the titles of nobility clause? Well, it may shock you to know this, but I don't know about every single little clause and every little thing that's in the Constitution. There are lots of strange little parts, and all of us need reminders from time to time what they are. Well, fortunately, we have a book by a fellow named Wexler, a professor from all the way up in Boston, and he has written us this wonderful book that he calls, appropriately enough, The Odd Clauses of the Constitution. And he's picked out a dozen or so clauses of the Constitution, and he's talked about them. So if you look at his book and you look simply at the table of contents, you'll see that he has written about, the incompatibility clause, whatever that is, the weights and measures clause. Did you know there was a clause of the Constitution that talks about weights and measures? I kind of did. And then something called the recess appointments clause. And that's a very important one. I'll stop there for a moment and introduce my former student. Her name is Michelle Caggiano. Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
And the reason I'm stopping at the recess appointments clause is because that's one of the reasons that Jay Wexler wrote this book, is because these obscure odd clauses have this strange way of popping up and becoming a lot less obscure, in fact, becoming right in the middle of the spotlight from time to time. So, Michelle, I understand you've got a situation to tell us about where the recess appointments clause actually has become a very recent interest.
It has. Actually, President Obama, at the end of December.
Of 2011.
Yes.
Yeah.
And had made a few appointments.
Mm-hmm.
And
now, when we say appointments, that means the president, taps someone on the shoulder and says, I appoint you to this agency or I appoint you to this job. And generally speaking, constitutionally, under Article 2, since the president's the head of the executive, that's perfectly okay.
Right.
If he wants to hire you as, postmaster of Grundy, Virginia, he can do that. But certain appointments take more cooperation, especially from the Senate of the United States, right?
Right. Most of the appointments have to be confirmed by Senate.
Right. The important appointments.
Right. Well, there's the exception with the recess appointments clause.
Okay. So what is this recess appointments clause? What is this?
Basically, when Senate is in recess, the president can appoint someone without Senate confirmation.
That's very interesting. Let's back up a little bit. These are important offices. And so the president can't just pick who he wants to hire. He has to ask the Senate to advise and consent to that. And that's the exception to the general rule that the president can hire whoever he wants. But then the exception to the exception is that the president typically can only appoint people when the Senate is in session.
Right.
Or exactly the opposite of that. No, it's when the Senate's not in session. Well, permanently anyway. But if the president wants to appoint somebody on a temporary basis, he can do so during a Senate recess. Did I state that correctly?
Yes.
Okay. And the reason for this recess appointments clause is because back in the day, the Congress wasn't in session that often.
True. And travel time. I mean, if something happened to somebody who was in, an office or had been appointed and something happened and Senate wasn't in session, it could have taken months for them to travel to Congress to appoint somebody, so they gave that power to the president.
Okay, that makes it clear. So the Secretary of State gets appointed in the normal process, and then he kicks the bucket.
Right.
And if the Senate doesn't happen to be in session, then you can go the better part of a year without a Secretary of State, except for the recess appointments clause.
Exactly.
All right. So now we know what this obscure little phrase is. If the Senate's in recess, the president can appoint someone. Does that person serve permanently or how long?
No. How the Constitution states it is, they're to remain in effect, his appointment, will remain in effect, but Senate must approve it by the end of the next session of Congress.
Or the appointment just expires, right?
Right.
Okay. Now we know what this recess appointment clause is. And yeah, it's obscure. And in fact, in some sense, it's kind of dull. You know, this is these sort of housekeeping things. But how did this become prominent recently?
Well, Obama had made some recommendations. And before Senate, you know, left for their last little break at the end of December, they hadn't appointed a head to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that was just created.
Right. Okay. So we had the recession and Congress created this new Consumer Protection Bureau. But it did it with a little caveat, did it? It said that they couldn't actually start working until they had a head. They had an agency head.
Correct.
And then I believe it was Senate Republicans.
Yes.
You tell me. Okay. They didn't particularly want this agency to go into effect, did they?
Not exactly. Their concern was how much power that department head had. They felt that the Congress should have a little more power than the department head there.
Okay. So they didn't particularly like this agency as constituted.
Right.
Do they like the guy that President Obama was trying to appoint to head it up?
No.
What was his name?
It was Richard Cordray.
Or I guess is his name. He's
is
still
his
alive.
Name, yeah.
Richard Cordray. Uh-huh. So President Obama wants Richard Cordray to come in and run this agency, and at least the Republicans in the Senate are balking at this, and they have a, I guess they have enough votes to prevent it from coming up for a vote, right?
Yes.
And so they just left town without appointing him. And as long as there's no head to this agency, the agency can't do much.
Right. Well, and then kind of though what they did, the problem was is that they created the pro forma session.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where the question is, were they really in recess?
Oh, okay. Pro forma session. Okay. Now let's get into that. So we know that presidents can appoint people if the Senate's in recess.
Right.
And normally that's pretty easy because, you know, they're out of town, right? But apparently, the Senate knows that presidents are going to sit around and wait for them to be in recess. And so what do? To defend themselves and prevent these recess appointments?
They create the pro forma session.
And what is that?
Either house that has no formal business that's expected to be conducted, they can usually just create a little session.
A little session.
A little session, even though there's nothing formal that's created during that time. It kind of makes it they're still there. So only a few members are there.
Basically, they have one senator stay back in D.C. They probably rotate this. And then the guy just gets up there and he says, okay, Senate's now in session. Any business? Seeing no business, boom. And then he gavels it shut. And so they have these like 5-second sessions or 5-minute sessions.
Right. And the Constitution says how many sessions Congress is supposed to have in this. Uh-huh. So sometimes they'll have them just to fulfill the obligation of the Constitution anyway. So
I see. But the word pro forma kind of gives it away. Pro forma means informed. Only.
Right.
You know, basically, or just, you know, kind of going through the motions. No real business is going to be transacted. And it was during one of those pro forma sessions that President Obama simply said, I don't think you're really in session.
Right.
So I'm just going to go ahead and I'm going to take the position that you're on recess and I'm going to go ahead and appoint this guy Cordray.
Right. And I think part of that was is that I've read some articles that are saying that, you know, they have asked President Obama to not appoint anyone when they left for their Christmas break. So they're not due back until January 23rd of 2012.
Uh-huh.
So they'd have this long Christmas break that he could have appointed anyone. So they said, well, we'll appoint some of these people, but we don't want to decide on these, but we want you to assure us that you're not going to do a recess appointment.
Uh-huh.
And he never said he wasn't going to uphold that. So they said, well, we'll do the pro forma session then. To try to prevent him from appointing.
But he went ahead and appointed him anyway.
That's right.
And so now we're going to have a court challenge to that. But in the meantime, Richard Cordray is now heading up this agency and acting like he's got all the power he needs, right?
He is.
So an obscure clause of the Constitution all of a sudden hits the front pages in 2012. And that's why this book is so intriguing. Thank you, Michelle, for telling us about that.
Oh, thank you.
Welcome, Jay Wexler, to your weekly Constitutional.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Absolutely. Now, I just have to ask. I have to make a confession. Your book really makes me angry, and it makes me angry for a very specific reason, and that is that I wish I had written it. It is such an excellent concept, and it's such a well-written book. It is so entertaining, much more entertaining than reading a law review article. And what gave you this idea? Why did you decide to write about the strange clauses in the U.S. Constitution?
Well, first, let me thank you for that. That's very kind. A lot of people are made angry by the book, but not for that reason. So I decided to write the book actually a long time ago, about 10 years ago, maybe it was a little more. I was working at the Office of Legal Counsel, which is a little office in the Justice Department that does advising on constitutional issues, and a lot of our questions that came in had to do with strange clauses that and parts of the Constitution that I had never studied in law school. I didn't really know anything about, like the Titles of Nobility Clause, for example, and I just thought, wow, someday this would be a great book to write, because people don't know about these clauses. They're pretty important. They're very interesting. And wouldn't it be a fun project to do? And I didn't get a chance to do it for a while, but it's, after I finished my first book about church-state law, I thought, this, now's the time to write this Odd Clauses book. I actually had the title Odd Clauses, I think, came along with the idea for the book at the very moment that I thought of it. So I've always been thinking of it as the Odd Clauses book.
Well, it seems to me to be the perfect marriage of entertainment, and I do want to emphasize that to people because I really am going to encourage them to go out and get a copy and read it because they're just going to have a blast with it. It's a perfect marriage of entertainment on the one side, along with the more serious pursuits of history and indeed simply of, you know, constitutional interpretation as well, because you make the point at several places in your book that I agree with wholeheartedly, that these clauses are not just interesting, they're very important in many cases, you know, some of them more historically than currently, but all very important, and they all share a couple of important traits. They give us insights into what the founders were doing, and also they, in some cases, because we don't care about them so much anymore, they really give us a wonderful laboratory in a dispassionate way to think about things and to recognize that how we look at the Constitution is going to affect how we interpret it.
Right. Well, I appreciate those views, and I also have to say I have to thank my editors for really pushing me towards thinking about the serious points I could make with the book. When I first started, I was drawn to the issue by or the topic by the trivia kind of stuff.
Like, right.
There's a Titles of Nobility Clause in the Constitution. Three of them, really? It's weird.
Exactly. Yeah.
But my editors told me, you know, very clearly where we think you can write a book which makes some serious points and think about what you can do for readers by talking about these odd clauses, and so I did that. And
well, I'm going to embarrass you. I'm going to quote you here because I was really impressed by this, and I'm looking at page 55 of your book when you're talking about the recess appointments clause, and you say, "It makes sense, then, when starting to think about how the Constitution should be interpreted, to do so in the context of some part of the Constitution that does not raise your blood pressure too much."
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, because, you know, when we think about the real big constitutional issues that everybody's always talking about, like abortion or affirmative action or free speech, things like that, we tend to have pretty firm policy views of what we think about those issues. And then, lo and behold, shockingly, our constitutional views coincide with our policy.
It is
views.
Remarkable how that works. It's remarkable.
Yeah,
it's but
amazing.
When you've got something like the recess appointments clause, for most people in most circumstances, it doesn't raise the blood pressure. But in fact, I'm going to suggest we start there. Among all these odd clauses, let's start there. And I'm going to start with a notation that you probably wrote this before the current controversy over that very clause.
That's right. That's exactly right.
So and, now it's not the best example because right now people's blood pressure is getting involved. But let's go ahead and start just about that one among the others, and then we'll pick a few others here as well.
Okay.
So tell me about
The recess appointments clause is very interesting. The framers, what it does is allow the president to appoint somebody to an office without Senate confirmation if the Senate is in recess.
Mm-hmm.
And it started off as an innocuous kind of clause, which made a lot of sense back in the 18th century, where you couldn't, where if senators went on vacation, they weren't going to be able to come back really quickly, and if there was a pressing need for the president to appoint an official while the senators weren't around, this clause gave him the power to do that. But nowadays, of course, it's very easy for everybody to get back, and so it's not really an incredibly necessary clause, yet it still exists, and presidents have used it to kind of circumvent political opposition to their appointees, and that's made it controversial.
It's made it very controversial. In fact, I like to actually quote the relevant language for our listeners. It's short. It's in Article 2, Section 2, and it says, "The president shall have power to fill up all vacancies that may happen during the recess of the Senate by granting commissions which shall expire at the end of the next session." And so you can see exactly why it was done, as you just said, back in the day when Congress was not in session that frequently and there were long recesses. It made an eminent sense. But now, when everybody can get back, the question becomes, do you ever really need to use this clause?
Mm-hmm.
And if not, then what? Why are presidents using it?
Yeah, it's like become it's being used for a completely different purpose now.
Okay.
And that begs the question of how courts should interpret it.
Well, first of all, how are presidents using it? Let's give me a couple of historical examples from recent history.
Well, President Bush, George W. Bush, used it to appoint a head of the UN who was very unpopular, the guy who actually thought that the UN shouldn't exist, which is sort of a strange choice,
right.
I thought. But a couple of federal judges that the Democrats were opposed to, and now Obama just recently used the recess appointment clause to put in Richard Cordray to head the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is a very controversial new agency that Congress established. And
so what happens then is that a president wants to appoint somebody, and the Senate, in its inimitable fashion, will simply refuse even to take up the subject. Okay, so I mean that's effectively their way of saying no. But it's very frustrating because it leaves the nominee hanging, it leaves the president hanging, the vacancy's not filled. In fact, that's a huge issue in our federal judiciary right now, as you know. And so the president gets frustrated, and so he starts to wait for that magical moment when the Senate's not in session. And then, boom, he's going to appoint somebody, and that, you know, the hope is that that will remedy the situation or that that person will simply get ensconced in office and eventually will be confirmed. But the Senate gets wise to this, right?
Right, the Senate gets wise, and they decide to hold pro forma sessions and continuously so that they're never on recess. And the Democrats did this at the end of the Bush administration, and the Bush and the Republicans had done it during Obama. And Obama's position, which was supported by the Office of Legal Counsel in an opinion, was that these pro forma sessions where the Senate's not actually doing anything don't actually take the Senate out of a recess. And so the president can still make these appointments under the recess appointments clause, even if the Senate isn't sort of officially on recess. And that's raised the hackles of the Republicans who are suing to invalidate the appointment, and we'll see what happens.
Well, before we get to that lawsuit, let's just mention, you mentioned the Office of Legal Counsel, and you explain in your book this is a very prestigious office. I believe you used to work there, didn't you?
Yeah, but they had me working on all the unprestigious parts.
Oh, I see. Okay. So you were the unprestigious guy that was brought in to clean up at OLC. Well, the Office of Legal Counsel is a specific office within the Justice Department, and it's sort of, as you explained, the president's lawyer. So when the president says, can I do this, can I do that, they will render an opinion. Now, it's not legally binding like a judicial opinion, but it's certainly very persuasive, and it gives the president guidance. And so you're saying the Office of Legal Counsel has gone both ways on this issue over the years, hasn't it?
That's right. It's issued opinions that say it has to be a long time before it's a recess, and then more recently it could be 3 days, and that counts as a recess. And now the most recent opinion is about these pro forma sessions and whether they could take the Senate out of a recess. And so the OLC has issued a number of opinions on this clause and what it means, as well as a lot of the other clauses in the book. And those opinions are important. I think that presidents treat them as pretty binding. I mean, it would be pretty shocking for the OLC to issue an opinion saying that the president can't do something and then have the president do it. Rather, instead, what the president would probably do is not ask Office of Legal Counsel in the first place if he thought that that they would come out the other way. And I think there is some criticism of it might be, I think this is in Obama, that there were some questions that the president asked the White House counsel or some other group other than OLC to write an opinion about.
Right.
So, get interesting.
But probably, as again you also point out, it's unlikely that these cases will ever result in a Supreme Court opinion because it's very difficult to figure out who has standing to challenge them. And even if the standing issue is overcome, courts are notoriously reluctant to get involved in disputes between the two branches of government. It's your weekly Constitutional. We're talking to Jay Wexler about the odd clauses of the Constitution. Stay tuned.
We're a couple of misfits. We're a couple of misfits. What's the matter with misfits? That's where we fit in. We're not Daffy and Gilly. Don't go round willy-nilly. Seems to us kind of silly that we don't fit in. We may be different from the rest. Who decides the test of what is really best? We're a couple of misfits.
I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm talking to Jay Wexler about the odd clauses of the Constitution. You think these cases will ever get heard by the Supreme Court?
Well, I think that this case, somebody will have standing, because somebody's going to have their rights affected by this Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that whoever that is will have standing.
So the Consumer Protection Bureau does something bad to somebody they disagree with, they object to it one way or another with a lawsuit, and then they question the actual efficacy of that appointment because in this particular case, the Consumer Protection Bureau was specifically inactivated until this appointment was made.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be the way that a private party might very well get standing in this case. But do you think the court would actually hear it, or would they punt on it as some sort of political question?
Yeah, that I don't know. I think you're right. There's remarkably few kind of separation of powers decisions that the Supreme Court has ever rendered, and that's in large part because it doesn't like to get involved in adjudicating disputes between the president and the Congress if it can avoid it. So I could, I don't know if. I don't know. I don't know if they'll hear this case, or if they do, they'll just say, we don't know. It's a political question.
It is, and it's been used for a long time. In fact, I think my favorite example you cited was Teddy Roosevelt, who was no stranger to executive power. And didn't he cite a constructive one-second recess between...
No, not 1 second, 0 seconds.
Oh, that's right. It was a session began and ended with the same gavel stroke, and he said, exactly. Oop, that was my chance. Here's 160 appointments.
I mean, the one-second recess, that would be easy. That'd be
right.
An easy case for him. But the 0 second, that's a little trickier. Yeah, so he said there had to have been a recess, in theory. And so I appointed a big group of people, in fact, during that constructive recess, which the New York Times the next day decried as being ridiculous and preposterous.
Well, in most of these political circumstances, of course, the ultimate arbiter of whether the president did right or did wrong is going to be the public, and I guess the court of public opinion will have a chance to weigh in on this and many other issues later this year in the presidential election. But it's interesting that we begin with a supposedly obscure clause that you cite as an example of something that doesn't get people's blood pressure up, and yet by the time the book is published, it has been revivified, and it's at the forefront, or at least recently was at the forefront of the newspapers. And so that's another point you make in your book, is that any of these clauses at any time could be front and center, just like the Second Amendment was dormant for so many years and became front and center with the Heller case just a few years ago.
That's right, and it's happened a few times since the book was published or was in process of being published. There was the issue last summer about the public debt clause of Section 4 of the Equal Protection of the 14th Amendment, and
Before we leave that, that was that obscure provision nobody was even aware of that said the public debt of the United States shall not be questioned.
Shall not be questioned. That's the strangest way to write a constitution. Is to use the passive voice.
Passive voice. Who does this apply to? And what exactly do you mean? And my understanding was that was a post Civil War. Well, of course it was. It was 14th Amendment. It was right after the Civil War, because there was some question about people coming to Congress and questioning the debts that had been incurred, either by the Union. Well, by the Union in that case to fight the Civil War.
Right.
Well, fine, but. does that affect our current battles over whether we're going to raise the debt ceiling or not? And that came front and center last summer,
Yeah, it was front and center. The Treasury Secretary cited it, and I think a lot of academics started then rushed, opened up their constitution, you know, and looked, found it, and then started blogging about it. And I think that the best reading of that clause is that it cannot really be relied on by the president to raise the debt limit unilaterally. So I'm glad it didn't come to that.
Yeah, that would have been a mess. Okay, well, let's get back to your book and the other odd clauses. I'll let you pick one. What's your favorite clause of the odd clauses that you wrote about?
Oh, boy, my favorite.
Yeah, what's the one
that... I had a lot of fun writing the Weights and Measures Clause chapter.
Then let's talk about that one, the Weights and the Measures. That's chapter 2 of your book. Okay, what does that one say? Let me see here. Let me pull up. It's on page 20. Yeah, I've got your book right here in front of me. I'm having a blast. It's... Article 1, Section 8, which is, as you point out, one of those big conglomerate sections that contains lots of very important powers of the Congress, like the commerce power, which is so much in the news lately with the health care bill, and the tax power, which is also. But it also has several really obscure powers, and some of them that seem almost laughably specific. And here is one: the Congress shall have power to fix the standard of weights and measures.
Right. And I think that was... enacted so that we didn't have different states using different measurements, which actually would be kind of humorous. But I think it was a good idea to not let that happen. And then, so Congress has the power to decide what we're going to use for our weights and measures. And our big controversy over the years on that score has been whether to use the metric system or not.
And so, and that's a long-running controversy.
Yeah, it goes back to the 18th century. And of course, we've never fully adopted it. We've flirted with it a few times. We allow people to use it, and companies, et cetera, and the government's supposed to use it. But we've never formally gone over, and so we're one of the only countries in the world that uses our strange foot and pound system.
Why did we start with that one? If right from the very beginning there was a debate between the metric system and the British system, why did we go with the British system?
I think because most of our trade was with England, and so the idea that we would switch over to the metric system would have interfered with our trade with Britain, and it also would have kind of allied us with the French, which we didn't want. And so it made some sense there at the beginning, but then when England switched, it started to make much less sense, it seems.
Right.
So it's a great history. Lots of things that I didn't really know about to learn about how the Reagan administration or the Carter administration created the metric board to decide whether we should go over to the metric system. But lots of people who were on the board were inherently opposed to the metric system anyways, and so they basically did nothing. They got ridiculed on Saturday Night Live, and ultimately they dissolved the commission, and now we still use, you know, gallons. And then, of course, as I talk about in the book, there was this great, or not so great, but ridiculous thing that happened where we sent the Mars rover up, which cost
$150 million. I love that fact. You began with that example, and you talked about the Mars Polar Explorer. And I admit, for the first sentence or two, I was thinking, what? Where's this crazy guy
Mars?
Going?
What?
Mars? And then I thought, I know exactly what it's going to be, and you're exactly right. So I'll let you tell the story. What happened there?
Well, we built this Mars rover for $170 million or something like that, and Lockheed Martin was involved, and NASA was involved, of course, and they sent it up, and it was supposed to go do some scientific experiments on Mars. But as it turned out, there was this confusion with what the units should be with on one of the parameters of the rover's engine or something, and so Lockheed Martin was using the English system, and NASA thought they were using the metric system, and they got all confused, and the Mars rover just flew out into space, and who knows where it is now? It's either orbiting around the sun or it's in some other galaxy. It didn't land on Mars, and we lost $150 million because we didn't we don't have this formal transition over to the metric system. So
Danger, Will Robinson. It's lost in space somewhere.
And so maybe somebody will find it.
Maybe somebody will find it, and there'll be some value to it. But what a ridiculous thing to happen. I remember when that happened because my kids were following it, and they were just appalled mm-hmm. that we're still using this ridiculous system of weights and measures. And even though it historically made some sense, when Britain went off this, I think you said in the 1960s, that was the last remaining reason to stay on. And I guess, do you have any idea why we haven't actually adopted the metric system, which the entire rest of the world uses?
Well, it could be because Myanmar also hasn't switched over.
Oh, of course, Myanmar, right.
It's got to be something about American exceptionalism. I don't know. I'm just guessing. But, we're not going to go along with the rest of the world. We're special, and we'll have special measurements, too.
And I guess it's because the French invented that metric system.
Frog-eating French.
We don't want to be French.
Absolutely.
We might turn into socialists or something, I suppose. It just makes no sense to me at all, but that's a fascinating subject as well. Now I have to ask you about one of my favorites, the Natural Born Citizens Clause.
Mm.
Now, what is the Natural Born Citizens Clause?
Well, the Constitution sets out the qualifications for people who run for president and vice president, senator, and representative and such, and the qualifications are very limited. You have to be a certain age, you have to have lived in the country for a certain amount of time, but that's it. There's no property, you don't have to own property or be from a certain family or a religion or anything like that, which is, given the 18th century, is kind of a remarkable thing about the Constitution. But there's this one requirement for the presidents, which is that they have to be a natural-born citizen. So you can't have been born overseas and then come over and become a citizen.
Let me read the actual language, and I note that it's at the very beginning of Article 2 in Section 1, which is, of course, the article that creates the executive, the presidency, and it says, "No person except a natural-born citizen or a citizen of the United States at the time of the adoption of this Constitution shall be eligible to the office of president." And when you read that, of course, the first thought that occurs to me is, so what about cesarean sections?
Exactly.
what do we mean here?
I don't really know. See, that's the thing is, we don't really know what a natural-born citizen is.
Uh-huh.
We know that if you're not a citizen, clearly not a citizen at the time that you're born, and then you become a citizen through our citizenship laws, then you were not a natural-born citizen. We know, like, Arnold Schwarzenegger is not a natural-born citizen. But there are a lot of sort of unanswered questions about who counts as a natural-born citizen and who doesn't. For example, John McCain, who was born in the Panama Canal Zone, probably is a natural-born citizen, but maybe not.
Mm-hmm. You could make the same argument with Barry Goldwater. I think he was born in Arizona while it was a territory.
Right, right. That sounds right. And Mitt Romney's father, I think, there was something. He's also an issue.
Uh-huh.
I mean, not anymore, but he was when he was running. So we don't really know what counts as a natural-born citizen or not. Of course, the natural-born citizen clause has become important. The cause of the birther movement, which has argued that Obama was not born in the United States, which is something I don't like really to talk about because it's not on my it doesn't raise the interestingness, I think, of the clause in the way I care about. But
you're right. That is why people are aware of the clause right now.
Right, right.
It's why
it's
become a little bit less obscure, even though it's still somewhat odd. What was the reason for it to begin with, and did it ever effectuate that reason?
Well, I think the reason was that the framers were afraid that we might have somebody who is really loyal to a foreign country being our president, and there was some cause for concern in the early days of the Republic where a lot of the people who could have become president had connections with other countries, France and the like, and there was a concern that maybe what was it I wrote about it but now I've forgotten something like Napoleon's brother or sister or something
like that. Yeah, I think it's
his
brother.
I can't remember what it is, but there was a concern that foreign prince would basically end up as the president of the United States, and that was the worry. And I guess it worked because we've never had a foreign prince as our president. But
well,
now,
I guess so. But yeah. I guess my thought was, though, that the clause seemed to defeat itself right from its exception, or excuse me, from its inception, because of the exception in there. It says except someone who's a citizen at the time of the adoption of this Constitution.
Right.
And many, many people throughout our history, and including at that moment in time, had been born elsewhere.
That's right. I think our first real natural-born citizen president was Martin Van Buren. Is that right?
Someone who was actually born in the United States after it became the United States under the Constitution. Right.
Right. Right. Right. And now, of course, the clause is just simply operates to prohibit people who would be possibly great presidents from becoming president, which is unfortunate. And I think it's the one clause of the Constitution that I find kind of distasteful. Not that I necessarily think we ought to amend it out, because I think there are problems with starting the amending process up. But you know, I think it's offensive to think that somebody who was born overseas but then came over to the United States and became a citizen and worked here their whole life and maybe served in the U.S. military, for example, could not become president of the United States. I think it's unfortunate.
It does, as you point out, create a second class of citizenship, at least in one remote, for most people, possibility. But in a situation where you're basically saying, yeah, you're a citizen, except you can't be our top leader.
Right. I mean, if somebody runs for office and it becomes clear that they are, in fact, beholden to some foreign prince, we could not elect them. That could be what we do.
Yeah.
We just don't vote for them.
Yeah, you just don't vote for them, I suppose, and it's not something that just affects Arnold and the Republicans. It affects the Democrats. Jennifer Granholm, who is a very notable governor of my home state of Michigan, relatively recently, and was often considered material to be on the presidential ticket, was disqualified because she was born in Canada.
Absolutely.
And there's not a lot of difference between being born in Canada and being born in the United States, especially when you live in a place like Detroit.
Exactly. There was the episode of 30 Rock where they were on vacation, had the baby in Canada.
Right. Yeah, and that's it's remarkable. In fact, there's an old riddle. It's if you stand in downtown Detroit and you look due south, what's the first foreign country that you will see if you are able to see that far?
Oh, right, yeah.
And most people will start guessing, oh, is it Mexico or is it Guatemala, or you know, they're thinking all this sort of stuff. No, it's Canada. South of Canada, exactly, because of the way Ontario hooks up underneath the Motor City.
That's so great.
Yeah, well, you can use that. You can use that riddle whenever you absolutely go ahead and use it in class before this broadcast, because then, of course, everybody in the world will know the answer.
That's right.
Let's move on to Chapter 8, which is the title of nobility clauses. That was fascinating as well, and I must say I'm very disappointed to know that I'll never be a noble.
Well, no,
or at least if I'm in Congress.
Yeah, that's right. You could become a noble.
I can't be all in Congress and be a noble at the same time, and that bothers me.
I'm sorry that there's a lot of disappointment that comes along with the book.
But disappointing, yes.
But it's not like, you know, that you could have become one of those things before reading it. So you didn't actually lose anything.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, tell us about these strange clauses. What is that?
Yeah, so these clauses... the titles of nobility clause prohibit the United States government or any of the states from granting titles of nobility to anybody. And they also prohibit officers of the United States from accepting titles of nobility from other countries. Mm-hmm. So this was the clause, in fact, that made me think about writing the book, because when I was working at Office of Legal Counsel, my friend was asked to decide whether... Or asked to research, anyways, whether President Clinton could accept some sort of honor from an African village when he was on a trip to Africa. And she was like, "What is this, a title of nobility?" And nobody, of course, had any idea whether it was a title of nobility. But so when that came up, that was the first moment where I thought of writing this book. So I was always going to include this chapter. It's very interesting.
Let me begin again. I'll quote from it. The first of these two clauses, Article 1, Section 9, it says, "No title of nobility shall be granted by the United States, and no person holding any office shall, without the consent of Congress, accept of any title of any kind whatever from any king, prince, or foreign state. And that's the first of the two. And then, as you say, it also applies to the states. It simply says no state shall grant any title of nobility. Okay, now, why were these put in there?
Well, the framers had a real distaste for this kind of distinction based on kind of class or, the idea that there would be some hereditary super class in the United States. You know, it's basically an equality provision that says that we're not going to have some people in the country who are dukes or whatever and other people who are regular people. And I think that's the main reason why we have it.
And what really strikes me is that not only did the framers think it was important, but subsequently lots of commentators said that this was among the most important provisions in the Constitution.
Yeah, well...
Because equality was so central to our self-concept.
That's true, and we didn't have, of course, the Equal Protection Clause until after the Civil War, so it really was the only kind of equality provision that was in the Constitution. So it kind of served that role all by itself for 160 years.
It's your weekly Constitutional, and we're talking to Professor Jay Wexler about his new book, The Odd Clauses. The Odd Clauses of the Constitution, that is.
One of these things is not like the other things. One of these things just doesn't belong. Can you guess which thing is not like the other thing before I finish my song? Now look closely. Look. Now, something here, one of these things, does not belong. Now, I'll give you a hint. It has to do with how many cookies are on each plate. Okay? You ready? No? Okay, keep looking. I look, too.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm talking to Jay Wexler about the odd little clauses tucked away in the United States Constitution. We often say in class that, you know, the original seven articles of the Constitution had not a single word about equality in them, and it was a new concept. There was a second constitutional moment, a second founding with the adoption of the 14th Amendment, Section 1, that had the first and only Equal Protection Clause, and we trace sort of our modern individual rights and analysis and all of our, emphasis on women's rights, our emphasis on racial rights to the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And yet we sometimes forget that that was a huge issue in our own revolution. It was a bunch of white property-owning guys in this country mm-hmm. who felt slighted by a bunch of white property-owning guys in Britain. And that was really a lot of George Washington's motivation for joining the revolution was that he felt that he'd been ill-treated by the sort of guys that he wanted to be. He wanted to be part of the club. And they wouldn't let him be part of the club. And so I eventually said, well, I'll lead the revolution. That was a huge issue for these founders.
Absolutely. Well put. I can't add anything to that.
So there is equality from the beginning of our constitutional history, and it was extremely significant. This is one of those moments when I learned a heck of a lot from that very short chapter in your book that I must admit I was just ignorant of beforehand, or at least I had not put it together with what I already knew about George Washington. So thank mm-hmm. you for educating me on that.
You're very welcome.
Now tell me about another strange thing that most people have heard of and they have no clue what it is. It's in Article 1, Section 9 and in Article 1, Section 10, and I'll quote them. No bill of attainder shall be passed by Congress. And then in the next section, Section 10, no state shall pass any bill of attainder. What is a bill of attainder, and why did they feel it was important enough to put in the Constitution?
So a bill of attainder is basically legislatively imposed punishment. If the legislature passes a bill and the bill names a specific person or people or a specific group of people, and basically imposes punishment on them, sends them to prison or gives them a fine or something else. That's bill of attainder, and the framers were very wary of those things. They were very popular in England and even in the colonies before the Constitution. And the problem was with those things is that they ran counter to everything the framers thought about separation of powers. The framers were obsessed with splitting up power so that we wouldn't have in order to reduce the likelihood that some group would be able to impose their will upon others, and so they split up the executive from the judicial, from the legislature. They split up the legislature into the House and Senate, and separated church and state, and all these things. And their view of how punishment should be imposed would be that you'd have the legislature pass a law that says you can't do something. You'd have the executive deciding if you had, in fact, violated that law. And then you'd have the judiciary adjudicate a dispute if you disagreed with the executive. So you'd have all three branches involved in a decision to punish somebody. A bill of attainder circumvents all that and just gives the legislature the power to...
It just undercuts it.
So it was...
Yeah, it's just utterly inconsistent. And let's emphasize how very important that is. Now, most kids learn about that in the eighth grade when they learn about so-called checks and balances. Mm-hmm. Fancy law professor types will talk about separation of powers, but whatever you call it, that was part of Madison's original conception in the Virginia plan, and it was so important to that plan that now I understand, you know, how important bills of attainders were, or the prohibition of bills of attainders, because nothing that can undercut that is going to be consistent with our general constitutional premise. And before we get into more about the bills of attainder specifically, let me give you another compliment. You touched upon one of my pet peeves, how our entire administrative law system, is utterly inconsistent with separation of powers. And as far as I'm concerned, if I were the Supreme Court for a day and I had my own five votes I could cast, that would all go by the boards and let the chips fall where they may.
Wow.
We would just figure it out.
I hope your listeners understand how radical that
it,
is.
It's extreme. Well, yeah, it's extremely radical. But doesn't that offend you too? The whole idea of the administrative state.
Well, somebody, you know, I teach administrative law,
right.
And it wouldn't be much of a course without that problem. But
let's explain it. I mean, you have an administration. I mean, pick an agency. I think you picked the Environmental Protection Agency as an example. It makes the law by adopting regulations effectively. They have the force and effect of law. It then prosecutes people effectively by finding people in violation of that law. And then it actually adjudicates disputes and finds people guilty of violating those regulations. And then at the end of that entire process, there is some minor judicial review, which is, of course, as you know, where the judiciary is very deferential to the administrative state. And it actually strikes me as rather Kafkaesque.
Yeah, it's problematic, and people don't, I think, really understand how problematic and how strange that is. So that's something I wanted to talk about at least briefly in the book. I think I talk about it in the Weights and Measures Clause chapter mostly.
Right.
Everything we've done in the administrative state for the last 50 years. Is based on that premise that we can do such a thing. So taking your position, we would basically render the entire government unconstitutional.
There's that old practicality coming into the discussion again, that old stare decisis concept. I guess you're right, I suppose.
No, I don't know. I mean,
I don't know. It's such a hard thing. On the one hand, it's such an offensive idea to have these all-powerful centralized administrative agencies, and it doesn't have to be EPA, it can be anyone you like, and it's so inconsistent with the idea of separation of powers. On the other hand, as you point out, it's been ensconced for 60, 70, 80 years, and what do you do? I mean, when you've gone so far down one constitutional road, could you ever actually go and change everything retroactively? I don't know if you could. I think you're right. The whole edifice would fall.
I mean, there are these proposals out there. Justice Breyer made it when he was a professor, and some of the Republicans are supporting it now, that where we would have agencies, in fact, not make rules but simply propose them to the Congress, which would then either vote them up or down,
right.
thereby kind of restoring some legitimacy to the process.
Indeed. Couldn't you go even further than that? And that's an excellent idea, by the way. Couldn't you go further than that and simply expand the federal judiciary and eliminate the adjudicative responsibility of these agencies?
I suppose you could. A lot more Article III judges.
Well, so.
I mean,
we're paying administrative law judges, probably not paying them as much. But it, from my perspective, if any federal agency comes after me, I want a real judge.
We need a lot of robes. Well, a lot of extra robes.
I would be happy to pay a little bit extra taxes to buy a few more judicial robes.
I might even get into the robe business.
Yeah, that would be an excellent idea. That would be an excellent idea. We could make a pile of money, Jay, and so I think we know where we're headed with this. That was a heck of a digression, and it just happens to be one of my pet peeves, and there is no simple solution to it. But since we were talking about bills of attainder and how they're inconsistent with separation of powers, I just had to point out that big festering issue of the whole administrative state, but let's, which is a big issue. But let's go back to bills of attainders, and I want to quote from your book again, because you point out that this was a serious issue. And in fact, here we are on page 162 of your book, and you say, an apparently typical punishment for men convicted of treason in the 18th century, and now you're quoting from this, you are to be drawn upon a hurdle to the place of execution, and there you are to be hanged by the neck, and being alive cut down, and your privy members to be cut off, and your bowels to be taken out of your belly and there burned, you being alive, and your head to be cut off, and your body to be divided into four quarters, and that your head and quarters be disposed of where His Majesty shall think fit. These were serious exercises of legislative power.
Yeah, I wish I had not run across that description, actually.
It was pretty nasty. I mean, that was what our founders were reacting to. And in fact, it's often been said, was it Franklin's famous quote, or was it John Adams who said that, no, it was Franklin who said, if we don't hang together, we'll all hang separately.
Mm-hmm.
They might not have been hung. They might have had lots worse things done to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And when that's what you're facing, you would really want to have some procedural protections in place.
You definitely would want to do that. But then you point out that as soon as the revolution gets going, a bunch of states start passing bills of attainders. Against who? Against loyalists, against Tories. So, I mean, as soon as we're worried about the British doing it to us, so we're doing it to them.
Mm-hmm. So
this was a real issue.
It was a real issue, and it's interesting that, like with equality, our kind of liberty provisions of the Constitution are almost all come later in the amendments, the Bill of Rights, not much later, but a little bit later. The actual original document only has, when it comes to liberty, this provision, really, and also the ex post facto provision. So this was the most important kind of liberty issue that the framers were thinking about when they wrote the original Constitution. It's interesting.
Well, we can all be thankful that it's unlikely that we will ever face having our privy parts removed and our bowels cut out, we still being alive. That's a nice thing to know, that probably we will not be subject to that.
I'm going to remember that the next time I feel sad. I'm going to remember, well, at least that's not going to happen.
At least that's not going to happen, or at least it's not, the legislature's not going to do it to us. Now, I suppose they could pass a statute and some judge could, then we'd have some Eighth Amendment issues,
right.
I guess. But let's go on to one more chapter, at least, before we leave this discussion. One of those things that everybody who reads the Constitution straight through, and incidentally, I recommend everybody do that at least once during his lifetime, but everybody who reads it through comes to this point where he's talking about letters of mark and reprisal, which is in Chapter 7 of your book. What are letters of mark and reprisal, and why was the Congress given the power to issue them?
They are letters that Congress used to authorize private ships to go fight pirates back in the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's really cool. I mean, and we had to think about this now. The Marines, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, that's where the Marines got their start, because you had the Barbary pirates, right?
That's right.
And they were preying upon American shipping because we were weak, because we had no navy, all the rest of it. And so what did we have to do to fight pirates, or to fight the British or the French who were trying to impress our sailors and take our cargoes? We had this vehicle.
Right. We gave privateers this official authorization to go out there and fight for us, and then take some of the booty that they captured for themselves. And there was a lot of complicated rules and these things called prize courts to adjudicate whether who gets the property, and it was a very complicated system, and that's how we dealt with problems on the high seas back before we had a standing Navy.
So it was privatization of our naval forces, and again, I'm going to quote you because this is the one where I laughed out loud and handed the book to my wife. We were in an airplane at the time. You mentioned prize courts and booty, so here's the quote. So-called prize courts existed to adjudicate claims among vessels that some particular booty had not been properly bootified and was therefore not bootylicious.
Yeah, those are not the official terms, but
right, as you note. But you really make the point there. I mean, this was an entire. It was like you, with this letter, which Congress, pursuant to the Constitution, is allowed to issue. You essentially say, okay, you are now official, and whatever you do on the high seas is no longer piracy. It is an act of war.
Yes.
And there was consequence to that. I mean, if ultimately one of these privateers was captured on the high seas and the opposing ship was about to execute the crew of the privateer as being pirates, they just pulled out their letter of marque.
Which hopefully they had handy.
Hopefully
nearby.
Had not gotten soaked or something, right?
This actually says,
I'm
yeah,
a soldier.
Right.
I'm not a pirate.
Uh-huh, right. Piracy was illegal under international law. You get executed for being a pirate. But if you had this letter, then you were not a pirate and you were not executed. So it was a pretty important letter. And so I had no idea what these things were, which was a good reason, I thought, to write about them and find out about them. And then you know, we, Ron Paul, not so long ago, raised the suggestion that maybe we use them, start using them again. We haven't used them since the War of 1812, but we've got the Somali pirate problem, and uh-huh. We're spending millions of dollars to send our Navy over to deal with that. Maybe we could deal with it more cheaply by using the market to solve our pirate problems.
There's another growth industry. We need to start investing in private naval warships.
Yeah. And there's a whole odd clauses.
Investment opportunities. Wasn't Jay Wexler a fascinating and funny fellow? I just love talking to that guy. I'm going to have him back on the show sometime. Well, Michelle, I want to know. I mean, you told us at the outset of this episode that Richard Cordray and the new Consumer Protection Agency is what brought this into everyone's, at least the recess appointments clause, that obscure clause, into the public consciousness in 2012. Is this a new phenomenon? I mean, is Obama the only president that's pulled these recess appointments?
No, not exactly. President Reagan, he appointed 243 people during recess appointments.
Wow.
Clinton, 139.
Uh-huh.
George W. Bush appointed 171. And one controversial one during the pro forma session also. Uh-huh. And Obama, at last count, was at 32.
I see. Well, he's got at least a little while longer to go, so we'll see if he comes up to rival some of his recent predecessors. Thank you, Michelle Caggiano, for updating us on the recess appointments clause. Thank you to Jay Wexler for telling us about all kinds of odd clauses in the Constitution. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, even the odd, obscure parts. It's your Constitution, and you need to learn about all of it.